Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and appreciate the opportunity. I apologize for the restriction on time, only because when you have a secretary in office, Secretary Gates coming into town, and he wants to go to Fort Greeley to talk about missile defense, I'm happy to oblige that and go with him to help him understand the importance of Fort Greeley and what's going on up there. Thank you, Bob, for the introduction. Appreciate that, and I hope to continue to make you proud as a local boy. There'll be bumps in the road, so don't hold that against me. Be kind. I have to make a comment about Governor Hickel. I was having lunch with Secretary Salazar recently, Interior Department Secretary Salazar. And as we were getting up, he said, you know, I met an interesting person in Alaska. I said, well, you know, of course, Alaska's filled with interesting people. And he says, Governor Hickel. And as he was telling me this story, we were in the Interior Department's office. They have the portraits of all of the secretaries, and they're these huge portraits. And just by a total fluke, there we were having this conversation about Governor Hickel, who explained to him about how Alaska really is. And here's the portrait of Governor Hickel. So Governor Hickel was doing the work. Wherever Salazar ran into him, he took him for about an hour, more than I got, Governor. I want you to know that. But he did a good job because Secretary Salazar then invited us over to have lunch, talk more about Alaska issues. So thank you, Governor Hickel, for carrying on Alaska tradition of talking straight and letting them know in Washington what we need. Also, let me do a quick introduction. My wife, Deborah, has joined me today, and her parents, retired Colonel Lou Benito and Herta, if they could just be acknowledged and stand up a little bit. Thank you. I have to say this about my in-law, especially Lou. He always worries about me. Now, Lou, when you see these pictures that you have not seen yet that we're about to show, that was just a vest. It wasn't a bulletproof vest. It was just a regular old vest that weighed 100 pounds. But don't be panicked. I'm here now. But also to Greg, thank you for the work you're doing here. Being a director of the World Trade Center is an incredible opportunity in advancing Alaska in the international marketplace. You know, the longer I'm in the Senate, the more I appreciate how interconnected and increasingly competitive our world is and has become. The World Trade Center does a great job connecting Alaska companies with potential customers across the globe and hosting important forums like this one today. And if you're not already a member, is this what I'm supposed to do, Greg? Join. Join. That's how I got my free lunch. That was my pitch. But do join. I mean, it's a great organization, and it does a lot of good work. We call on them quite a bit from our office, especially around international issues. And many of the folks that are up here from the forum to the World Affairs Council, all of them are important pieces to us in promote this state in the sense of an international perspective. Now, I have to tell you, I am truly glad to be home. Over the past week or so, I've logged over 20,000 miles around the globe in temperatures above 90 degrees and in Kabul, 107 degrees. And if that wasn't warm enough, this small little item I wore added several degrees to it. We were well protected and well versed on the needs as we went through the country, which I'll describe here in a few minutes. Let me note on the outset that I can't say enough about the sacrifices our servicemen and women and the thousands of American civilians are serving the Middle East are making on our behalf. They are doing truly heroic and vital work and deserve our thanks at every opportunity we have to show it. Please join me in doing a round of applause and thanking our military and those serving abroad. You'll see in a little bit some of the photos I've had with them. Well, there's one right there, me having that nutritional meal I'll describe later. But Congress is right now wrapping up our Memorial Day recess, which tomorrow I'll be flying back at 7:30 in the morning. There are two things. Usually people try to do one of them, which is visit their constituents or go overseas or go see some area of the world that needs to be reviewed by their committee. What I did was both. I thought it was important. And then immediately following this luncheon, I'll go up, as I mentioned, with Defense Secretary Gates to travel to Fort Greeley, talk about the missile defense system, also to introduce him to our National Guardsmen and women who are doing an incredible job up there in serving our country, to give him a sense of what Alaska is about and what's going on with our ground-based missile defense system. But also having him here is also important because the flight here from Asia and then from here back to D.C. hopefully also shows him in real time, real physical ability, why Alaska is strategic in the military defense of our country. As North Korea continues to test weapon systems capable of reaching Alaska and other states, the mission at Fort Greely is clearly more essential than ever before and more important to show off on a national level. Today, I want to report on two fronts: the international challenge, the stable, peaceful world, and the domestic challenge to getting America's economy back on track. On both, I think we're making good progress. But I want to appeal to each of you to stay engaged in the public policy discussions to help us develop working solutions. Now, I will say that Alaskans are not bashful about that. Everywhere I go, someone is handing me a note, a book, and wherever art is here, thank you for the book on Kashmir, which I have here. But everywhere I go, there's usually some advice or ideas that people give me, which, if you remember my days as mayor, I would put those in this top pocket, go back to my poor staff, and say, I have some new ideas. And they would all come from you all. So thank you for doing that. Every congressional observer has said the past 5 months in Washington have truly been the busiest in memory. That's because we are facing the most challenging times in recent history. Two wars, unpredictable threats from rogue Asian nations, and the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Not to mention a few little back burner issues like health care reform, global climate change, energy crisis, just to name a few small little items we'll be dealing with. The good news is the new Obama administration is working well with Congress and to address these issues. Just since January, we've passed numerous major pieces of legislation in a bipartisan manner, which includes the American Recovery Reinvestment Act, which will bring over $1 billion to Alaska, creating and saving an estimated 8,000 jobs and providing tax relief for thousands and thousands of Alaskans. An expansion of health care for children of working families. Congress fully funded this program for the next 5 years. But until our legislature and governor act on this and take advantage of this great deal, which is paid by the federal government 70 cents on the dollar, 1,200 children will not have health care until that occurs. So I'm looking forward to, I know Les has been a big a proponent of this, supporter of this, and hopefully next legislative session they'll take action and then receive an additional 70 cents on the dollar, providing up to 1,200 kids with additional health care. We've also enhanced consumer protection for credit card users, anti-fraud efforts aimed at mortgage malpractice, a Fair Pay Equity Act, comprehensive public lands bill, which affected Alaska significantly, a reform in how our weapon systems are purchased and acquired, small business assistance, community service to encourage more Americans to get involved in their communities, protection of the Second Amendment rights, and the list goes on and on and on. And I have to emphasize, even though, you know, you watch TV, it seems like all we're doing at times is struggling and fighting with each other. But all these bills I just listed are done in a bipartisan way, some passing almost totally unanimous. So what you sometimes see and what is really happening are two different things. There's a lot of good work going on back there between Republicans and Democrats trying to resolve the issues we face as a country and taking on enormous issues. When we get back to Washington, literally starting tomorrow, the major issue facing us next year, over this next few months, will be next year's federal budget, which includes funding for America's presence in South Central Asia. You know, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, the first time since an Alaskan has served on the Armed Services Committee since 1968, I'm truly honored to be on that committee and proud to serve Alaska on there. With nearly 30,000 active military men and women in our state, thousands of them serving in harm's way, and more veterans per capita than any other state, it is vital we look out for the interests of Alaska soldiers and veterans. For months, we have had an all-star lineup appear before the Armed Services Committee to detail out America's defense posture from Secretary Gates, General Petraeus, Air Force Chief of Staff, which is a familiar name to us here, Norty Schwartz, from whom many of you remember from services here in Elmendorf. You know, there's a unique advantage, I have to tell you, sitting there in Armed Services Committee, and as each general comes up, and there are a lot of generals back there, I got to tell you, that are coming up, Many of them I have met or seen here in Alaska. So the relationship is an amazing opportunity for us to get our issues put across. When Nori Schwartz was there and was talking about the Air Force budget, and I could bring up a couple Alaska issues, he was very clear on it and understood it. And that's a huge advantage for us. But my question, besides the Alaska issues, my questions to them are pretty simple. Does America's mission in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other world trouble spots make sense? And do our troops putting their lives on the line every single day have all the resources they need to carry out the missions, and the families they have left behind to serve that mission, are they taken care of? Getting firsthand answers to those questions was a primary reason I joined four other senators in traveling to Afghanistan and Pakistan last week. Our delegation was led by Delaware Senator Tom Carper, included Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire, Mark Udall from Colorado, and Kay Hagan from North Carolina. Four of us are freshmen. All of us serve on defense or homeland security committees, and each of us have significant military presence in our states. And with each of us, we brought a staff person with us, which I'm going to just digress for a second, because I am very fortunate to have someone who is in my staff, on my staff, helping me is Army Major Jim DeLapp, who has been serving the Defense Department fellow. He's serving as a Defense Department fellow in my office since January. Jim has served in every combat theater in the last 10 years, including 15 months as a battalion executive officer in Afghanistan. He is one of the most capable and energetic soldiers I've encountered, and Alaska is well served to have him in our staff. This is, I think, one of the only photos we had together, but you can't see the backpack he has there. That backpack was small when we started, but we got a lot of material, a lot of issues when we moved forward. I think that backpack weighed, by the time he was done, well over 100 pounds. And he's just smiling right there, but I got to tell you, there was a lot of pain carrying that in 100-plus degree weather. Let me tell you a little bit about the trip. We departed Washington Thursday a week ago for a 12-hour flight to Dubai. And, you know, it's funny, some of my colleagues were saying, oh, 12 hours. Now, 12 hours is long on a plane. But then I got an opportunity to remind them when I come home for the weekends, the length of time I have to travel. One, I was trying to gain a little sympathy. So when I have to lobby them on some issues in the future, I got a couple score points. But then early next morning, we went to Kabul in Air Force C-130. If everyone's been in the C-130, we missed out on first-class seating. This was our seat. And behind there, you can barely see it. There's this metal bar that goes across, and it did leave a mark on my back as I sat there. But one amazing thing, the phones worked about everywhere we went. I won't tell you my carrier because that would be promoting, but it worked. You know, as you look at Afghanistan, it's known as the crossroads of Central Asia. Afghanistan has a turbulent history of invasions, beginning with Alexander the Great, in the area of in the time of 328 BC. Most recently, you remember the disastrous Soviet occupation in the 70s. After the Soviet withdrawal and the Afghan government, it deteriorated, and anarchy and the warlords controlling various parts of the country. This gave the Taliban a window in which they rose to power. By the end of 1998, about 90% of the Texas-sized country, Afghanistan, was controlled by the Taliban. The Taliban sought to impose an extreme interpretation of Islam on the Muslim people of 30 million. It committed incredible, terrible atrocities against minority populations and massive human rights violations, especially against women and children and girls. The Taliban also provided sanctuary to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda terrorists. The bombing of the U.S. embassies in Africa and the 9/11 attacks against America were hatched here by bin Laden. In late 2001, thanks to America and the international resources, the Taliban disintegrated and abandoned the capital of Kabul. 3 years later, Afghanistan held its first democratic presidential election, electing President Karzai to a five-year term, which he's currently running for re-election. You can imagine with five politicians sitting around someone in a country like this, one of the questions we did ask, what's it like running for re-election in a country like this. One of my members said, do you go door to door? And you can imagine the response as we were surrounded literally by armed guards all around us. He says, that's a little difficult. But he described the experience. But just the fact that in less than 3 years, they elected a president, and now they're going through a re-election process, shows there is movement. Maybe some hot spots still and significant issues still to resolve. It is showing that there is movement. Although the cabal is relatively stable, the Taliban and al-Qaeda continue to operate throughout the country and across the border in neighboring Pakistan. These terrorists present a clear and continuing threat to the United States and our allies. To take the fight to the Taliban in the south and east, President Obama ordered the deployment of an additional 17,000 additional American troops in March, which are now starting to move and arrive, which will be completed by August of this year. This includes Alaska's 425 Airborne Brigade combat team headquartered in the eastern part of Coast Province. Alaska has nearly 10,000 servicemen and women currently deployed, which ranks us sixth among all the United States for the number of soldiers serving in harm's way in this region. In Afghanistan, our goal is to help build up the Afghan army and police forces so that they can provide security for their own country. President Obama believes this, that we can do this by 2011. After my visit, I also believe that this is possible. At the same time, it is America's interest to help Afghanistan develop its economy, which is dominated by illicit drugs. Heroin produced from thousands of acres of poppy fields is currently the country's chief cash crop and export commodity. This will truly require a building an economy from the ground up, with agriculture specialists, educators, engineers, and lawyers, which between us and the coalition forces have an enormous amount of civilian forces there to help make this happen. 90% of the worldwide production of poppies comes from this area. And so we believe that as we move forward, actually an interesting thing we learned as we were there, the wheat prices are now the same as the poppy prices. So there's an economic model that they're starting to impose to change out the fields. In Afghanistan, we were briefed by senior American leadership. Ambassador Eikenberry has been on the job for just 2 weeks. General McKiernan, soon to be replaced by General McChrystal, also were people who briefed us while we were there. Their consensus is that in the new emphasis on the combat theater, after years of applying most of our resources in Iraq, is not only welcomed, but vital. Of course, there are still enormous challenges. Unlike Iraq, it's especially difficult to move supplies into the landlocked Afghanistan, where 80% of the material we need to move in there has to come through and flown through Pakistan with very limited routes. The Afghan Interior and Defense Ministers echoed the same message, that Afghan National Army has been a great success, but its size should be doubled to at least 400,000 troops. And we are working with them, along with our coalition forces, to do that, to train them to manage their own affairs. The National Police has not been so successful. So the focus must be on eliminating corruption within the police force there and increasing its effectiveness, which the Interior Department Minister is clearly on this track. He's imposed new regulation and new processes on the corruption issue, as well as a welcome social progress. A pilot program is underway to have women serve in the Afghan police, working side by side with a brother or a father. They're even trying to provide child care to encourage female employment. We wrapped up our Kabul visit with President Karzai, who underscored his appreciation for the long overdue increased U.S. forces. And I can't stress that enough, his appreciation for our country's sacrifice, but also the coalition forces' sacrifice. But he also talked about their sacrifice and the members that they have lost in their armed services along fighting side by side with us. But he wanted to really stress the point that it's appreciated and the impact of the new forces, but also the trainers that are coming along are going to be an enormous part of the equation. We met with several Alaskans, including Major Benjamin Anderson from Fairbanks, shown here. I got to see which photo that is. That was what they called an air-conditioned tent, which was probably 90 degrees. We're not sweating there, but I'll tell you, it was hot. Teresa Thacker from Wasilla, who is working in the U.S. Embassy. It was funny talking with her. She told me a little bit about what she did, and she's like, I can't tell you much more than that. And I thought, okay. And then when she told me where she worked, I said, now I understand. But she was so appreciative of an Alaskan visiting, but just having the troops were so appreciative of having U.S. senators there on the ground talking to the troops and listening to their concerns and their issues. For each one of the Alaskans I met, I'm actually calling their families to report on their visit, on my visit, and to assure them they're doing great work back there. And I've actually made some of these calls, and I have shocked a few people when I've called them, because what we asked with each member to tell us who would they like me to call. And so they filled out a little form, and I said, I'll call them. And, you know, I know lots of times when we leave, they think, oh, you know, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But they've actually been exciting, enjoyable calls to talk with them, to tell them their loved one is in good shape and doing a great job back there, and just showing a little appreciation. And each senator committed to do that, which I think is a great message to send back. We next traveled to Regional Command South, where 17,000 American troops surge will be located. This region is the hotbed of Taliban activity. It has the highest fatalities, as the highest rates of incidences with and engagements with the Taliban. And meeting with the governor of the Helmand province and military commanders and all who are all focused on developing better local governance and providing alternate crops to the very profitable poppy. The governor we met with, you know, we think of what we have to do in political office. This governor has had 6 attempts on his life. One, he was in a vehicle, and they tracked him, the Taliban, and they used an actual missile to try to get to him. They missed him. So they live under unbelievable conditions, because what he is doing in this province, in the hotbed where about 3/4, 66% actually, of the poppy is grown and what he governs, he's trying to convert that crop into an alternative crop for the people there, so it's not the illicit drugs. That is an incredible task, because it is a huge chunk of money that the Taliban receive from those crops. So he takes his life, his family, as well as many of his colleagues' lives in his hands when he does this. But he has done amazing things. Besides starting to convert some of the crops, he has built over 20 schools in the area. Schools are an important part of the infrastructure. With only 10% literacy rate in Afghanistan, it is important that education be introduced for both boys and girls, and he does this in his community. And it's amazing to meet with him. We actually had to meet on the military base because of security issues. It is clear, in my mind, the military force alone is not the solution to the problems of Afghanistan. The military provides security and space for other agencies to focus on development. The counterinsurgency strategy is very clear. It's clear it, hold it, and build it. And build it is important for the vital long-term success and sustainability of Afghanistan. It's building roads and water and sewer. It's ensuring they have education facilities for today and into the future. You know, it was not long ago, 30, 40 years ago, Afghanistan was a net exporter. They were exporting food products out. They had one of the finest irrigation systems in that region. And it's because it goes all the way back to the Roman Empire, when the irrigation systems were actually built. And they had incredible utilization of that until it was all bombed out in the 70s under the Soviet invasion. So the potential is there, but it's important that the military is a piece of adding security, but the long term is ensuring that the people have the resources to move their country forward. The situation in neighboring Pakistan is much different. Although directly linked to Afghanistan's future, twice the size of California, with a population of 170 million, more than 5 times Afghanistan, Pakistan is a sophisticated and thriving nation. It has relatively high literacy rates and has developed and possesses nuclear weapons. Now, this next thing I'm about to mention, I did not tell this to my wife, so she's about to hear this for the first time. But I'm here, so don't worry about what I'm about to say. In a briefing we received before our trip, one expert got our attention when he declared Pakistan the most dangerous country in the world. The reason? It's the hotbed of Islamic extremism, a recruiting depot for al-Qaeda. It has a nuclear arsenal and a weak civilian government to protect those nuclear weapons. And it is the home to more terrorists per block than any other place on Earth. The major driving force in the Pakistan policy is the rivalry with India, largely over the controlled, disputed territory of Kashmir in the northeast. Pakistan has the world's eighth largest armed forces, but most of the troops are lined up on the Indian border. The single focus has allowed the Taliban and al-Qaeda to establish strongholds in Pakistan, which have preyed upon both the Pakistani people and Western nations. In this picture, I'm assuming you can see it fairly, the red is what you have to see. That is the Taliban control of Pakistan. The gold color is the contested control. Now, this map has started to change more recently, as I'll describe here in a bit, but that gives you a sense. And I saw a map about 3 years ago of what this looked like, and the red was very small compared to where it is today. Al-Qaeda has killed thousands of Pakistanis since 9/11, including having its hands in assassination of the former Prime Minister Bhutto. In recent months, an estimated over 2 million Pakistani people have been forced from their homes, with some living in refugee camps, which serve as recruiting sites for terrorists. Much of the fighting and displacement of the population is taking place in the Swat Valley, a gorgeous former vacation spot for many Pakistanis, also once known as the Switzerland of Pakistan. You remember just a few weeks ago, the Taliban was within 60 miles of Islamabad until Pakistan forces pushed them back. American policy in Pakistan is providing assistance to help strengthen the economy with new schools, roads, hospitals. The worst turn of events for the world would be the Taliban controlling a government in Pakistan with their fingers on nuclear weapons. Afghanistan and Pakistan are closely linked, not only because of their shared border, but because of the Pashtun people span both countries. Everyone who knows anything about this region believes we can address the problems of Afghanistan only by dealing with Pakistan. Regional issue, regional solution. Our first day in Pakistan was in Lahore, considered the cultural capital, with the third largest city, which had not been greatly affected by the Taliban insurgents, which changed literally 48 hours after our visit, when a suicide bomber attacked at the police headquarters, killing more than 30 people and injuring more than 300. Also in Lahore, we met with the leading regional journalists, with business leaders in the Pakistan-American Business Forum. The governor of the Punjab province, one of Pakistan's largest with 81 million people, hosted a lunch. On a fun little note, it was topped off with a special little dessert, baked Alaska. You know, we bring a little bit of Alaska wherever we can go. I do have to say that one of the opposition leaders, as I was walking out of the meeting, one of the meetings, leaned over to me and says, "Did you bring any of that Alaska salmon with you?" And actually we had, but I was giving it to the troops. We had little packets of smoked salmon jerky. But just the fact that he was interested in that, quickly I told my staff, let's make an opportunity for him to see some of that. Again, in the capital, we met with Ambassador Patterson, who introduced us to the 37-year-old mayor of Karachi. Now, I thought my job was challenging when I was mayor, but it was fascinating to hear how he delivers services to 18 million people when he does not, as a city mayor, control the police force. So it is amazing to listen to him as a 37-year-old mayor who also has had many attempts on his life. Because, again, any time you disrupt the economic model of the Taliban, they're going to come after you. Because it's a business model, they don't want to interrupt it, because that money that comes in may be through the poppy trade, and his ports are a critical part of that. So he's been really leaning hard on creating an interference on that poppy trade through his water ports. But anytime you mess with that, the Taliban takes action, and they are serious about it. We also met with the Pakistani President Zardari and Prime Minister Jilani and the Chairman of the Military Joint Chiefs of Staff. The message from Pakistani leaders was the same. The nation is facing a very trying times, with the Taliban in control of several provinces, as that map I showed you earlier. After seeing dramatic footage of a woman being beaten in the Swat Valley, Pakistani public opinion changed. It seemed to change literally overnight. And now the military has the full backing of the communities throughout Pakistan to take and expel the Taliban from their country. This is a huge change of events. I can't stress enough from the discussions we had heard prior, before we left, to where when we landed there. The change in the public's attitude, the Taliban was almost in Pakistan tolerated. Now they want them out, which has made a huge effort. And the military has taken that and been able to now utilize that to their advantage to now start to move the Taliban out of their country. Overall, I have to tell you, my visit, I was encouraged. Without doubt, progress will be slow. But the leadership in both countries seems firmly committed to ridding the nation of the Taliban and protecting their fragile democracies. As a senator, my job will be to monitor a policy there and closely examine funding requests from their administration. It is certainly not cheap, but once a commitment I made to our troops, that if we're asking them to implement the policies we set forward, there is no question in my mind they will get the resources and equipment necessary to do the job to support the policy. On the other side of the globe, the world faces different kinds of threats. And I know everyone here in Alaska is following the North Korea latest antics, the successful launch of the Tau Po Dong rocket early last month, testing a nuclear device last week, and then renouncing the armistice that halted the Korean War in 1953. We in Alaska are especially nervous because we are directly in the line of fire, the easiest American state for North Korea to target. Fortunately, the ground-based missile system in Fort Greely is our front line of defense. Greely currently houses 26 missile interceptors maintained by the members of the Alaska National Guard. The interceptors can be launched to intercept an incoming enemy missile. It's an eye-popping technology, not much different than a bullet hitting another bullet in mid-flight. Thanks to testing at the Kodiak Launch Facility, the system works amazingly well. Another key element is their overall system is a sea-based X-band radar. This kind of golf ball-looking piece of equipment, you can see it there in the slide, the SBX radar tracks and assesses the flight characteristics of the ballistic missiles. It is currently undergoing testing in Hawaii and will eventually be based in ADAC. As part of the overall modernization of America's defense strategy, Secretary Gates has proposed essentially freezing the system at its current level. Instead of building new silos at Greely to house an additional 13 missiles, this would save a projected $1.6 billion in fiscal 2010 federal budget. Senator Murkowski and I have joined a number of other senators in a bipartisan effort expressing the seriousness and serious reservations about freeze directly to the President and Secretary Gates. The Secretary told us just 2 weeks ago that he believes the current deployment is adequate to address any challenges from North Korea and others, but he's willing to take another look. I'm pleased that he accepted our invitation to visit Alaska to personally inspect the facilities in Greeley, and I look forward to continuing the conversation with him in the new administration as we move forward to demonstrate Alaska's essential role in our national defense. I don't know how the seating arrangement's going to be on the plane, but I'm going to sure muscle my way to be right next to him. Even though it's a short flight, 45 minutes for me is like a lifetime in politics. So it gives me a great chance to hopefully engage him. As Congress and the national administration work together on international challenges facing our world, domestic concerns lead the list that I hear from Alaskans. And that's certainly understandable given the toll the national recession is having on American families. Just a few months ago, all the indicators were negative, a record 3.6 million jobs lost since 2007. Bankruptcies up a third, and new housing starts down by nearly half. Now the tide seems to be turning a certain degree. The stock market is creeping back. Sales of previously owned homes are up nearly 3%, and most economists predict the recession will end this year, although the recovery will continue a bumpy road. It appears some of the economic recovery measures passed by Congress, especially the new investments and tax cuts in the stimulus bill, are starting to provide assistance. Before concluding today, I want to quickly address two domestic issues that I know each of you are concerned about. First is health care reform. This is gearing up to be one of the summer's busiest, or one of our busiest activities this summer. It is a huge issue for everyone, including industry. In 2007, businesses in this country spent over $500 billion on health care. When you add in the dollars that individuals spend on health care, the numbers are staggering. Almost 20% of America's GDP. The problem in Alaska is also huge. More than 115,000 Alaskans are uninsured. Nearly 18% of our population, some 80% of the uninsured here, are from working families who can't afford the cost of care. It's no wonder so far this decade insurance premiums have grown nearly six times faster than wages. The good news is health reform is on the front burner. President Obama has outlined his principles for addressing reform and pledged to work with Congress as it prepares legislation. I believe health care should be accessible and affordable for all Americans. My priorities on health care are fairly simple: making sure that the number of people with health care coverage, increasing the number, making sure people can keep the insurance they have, ensuring people who have doctor choice, and covering people with pre-existing conditions. I also will work hard with the veterans' health care and strengthen our Indian health care services that are so important to Alaska. The second domestic issue I want to address is something I believe will do more than any other single project to help revive America's economy, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. As efforts to deal with climate change pick up momentum, there is no more abundant clean burning fuel than natural gas. It produces 30% less carbon dioxide than oil, 45% less than coal. America remains the world's largest natural gas importer. We're buying gas from Canada, Algeria, Nigeria, and now even Russia. Yet everyone in this room knows Alaska's North Slope holds enough gas to help supply our U.S. for decades. At an estimated price tag of $30 billion, the Alaska Gas Line Project will be the largest construction project ever in North America. Building it will require 50 million worker hours, hiring tens of thousands of workers, and it could reinvigorate the America's steel industry, requiring up to more than 10 times the steel needed for the oil pipeline. With all this promise, why aren't the bulldozers pushing dirt? There's no easy answer. But I join a growing chorus both here and in Washington who are frustrated the lack of progress on this project. During his campaign, candidate Obama embraced the Alaska Gas Line. Now, as president, he has designated it one of the top five green energy priorities projects for his administration. In recent conversations I've had with the president and his advisors, I know they were also frustrated with the lack of progress on the gas line. When I met with the president in the Oval Office recently, President Obama raised the issue without me even prompting him. As the economy recovers and the nation's appetite for gas grows, Alaska Gas will be poised to grab a share of the market before the window closes on us. As companies sink billions into new LNG projects and Canadian shale production and sign up on long-term buyers for their gas, Alaska could find itself pushed out of the market well past 2020. Instead of treating Alaska Gas Line as an Alaskan project, I'm urging the Obama administration to elevate the Alaska Gas Line to the national energy agenda for many reasons. More than half of the proposed pipeline route covers federal lands, United States and in Canada. The gas will be delivered to customers across the country. Issues involving lands, economy, energy, and jobs make it a national project. Finally, as we witnessed for years, this is a very difficult time to put this project together. It needs national leadership to pull it off. I believe it will take the highest levels of the national government to determine the gas line is vital to meeting America's energy needs to make it a success. I'm confident the Obama administration understands this and the potential of Alaska gas for the country's energy future and is prepared to work with us to encouraging this ambitious effort. Truly, I look forward to working with Congress in the coming months to kickstart the Alaska Gas Pipeline for the benefits of the entire country. As I touched on today, our state and nation face huge issues and challenges here at home and abroad. On many fronts, we have good progress, and there is enormous opportunity ahead of us. It has been so far a great honor to serve you in the U.S. Senate, and as you said earlier, I hope to continue to make you proud. It is an exciting time for this country and for our state to be at this pivotal point when it comes to defense, energy, and many other issues. Thank you for allowing me a time to give you a quick update on what's happening internationally, what's happening domestically, and if you want to learn more, I would not subject you to this, but I would be remiss if I didn't say you can go right online and sign up to one of our new newsletters that will be coming out soon, every couple of weeks, and to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., and keep well in tune with what's going on and what we're trying to do back there. But again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you and, again, give you an update. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a report from the battlefield, progress in the Middle East and Washington, an address delivered by U.S. Senator Mark Begich last week in Anchorage. Following his tour of Afghanistan and Pakistan, Senator Begich provided his perspective on progress in the world's most dangerous region at a luncheon hosted by the World Trade Center of Alaska on Monday, June 1st. You can find links to the photos he discussed in his speech on our website, kska.org. Senator Begich's address is the first of many local events we hope to record and share with you on KSKA FM 91.1 in the coming months. Next month, we'll bring you an update on the Denali Pipeline Project with Pipeline President Bud Fackrell, who will be addressing Commonwealth North on June 10th in Anchorage. If there's another special event or presentation coming up in Anchorage that you would like to hear on KSKA, please let us know. Just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the top of the page to share your ideas and recommendations. All of our locally produced programs are archived on our website and are available for you to download anytime at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA Public Radio. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.